I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Professor Stephen M. Cohen of Hebrew Union College, discussing his findings from the new Portrait of Bay Area Jewish Life and Communities and its implications for the American Jewish community of 2018. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Two Jewish Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Shinshinim, Chen Denachi and Tamir Shakuri. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. We are now less than 2 weeks before Passover, and as we prepare for the coming Festival of Freedom, one central fact about this great holiday needs to be noted. It is, at heart, a primal story about both emigration, leaving slavery and a nation that brutally persecuted its minorities, and immigration, about a ragged mass of former slaves who moved to a new promised land seeking personal and religious freedom and the opportunity to build lives based on their own hard work and dedication. We Hebrews were wanderers from our earliest beginnings with Abraham and Sarah, but we became a nation of wandering Jews, or at least wandering Israelites, I guess, when God and Moses took us out of Egyptian bondage and led us to Israel. Immigration is in our souls, probably in our DNA. There's even a kind of Darwinian reason for this. Jews who did not leave their home countries seeking a better life often were murdered there, and those communities diminished or disappeared, while the Jews who immigrated seeking a better life often flourished in spite of the dangers involved. And that means that it should be virtually impossible for any Jew not to understand what motivates immigrants who seek to come to a nation that promises freedom and opportunity. Our sympathies always are with those who try to find a life free of persecution in countries where they have the possibility to create lives of safety, success, and stability. That makes the current anti-immigrant rhetoric in America particularly painful. We know that everyone in the United States is descended from an immigrant. Even the Native Americans walked here on a land bridge from Asia. And the idea that any of us have forgotten that our ancestors were migrants themselves, many of them not terribly well documented, should be profoundly disturbing. It's true. America has typically had both pro- and anti-immigration strains in its ideology. Usually, businesses want more immigrants, and poor laborers want fewer, since they tend to see immigrants as economic competitors who lower wages. There have even been entire political parties based on anti-immigration sentiments, like the well-named anti-Catholic Know Nothing Party that tried to stop Irish and even German immigration in the 19th century, and that took over 20% in a national presidential election. But the larger truth is that America, as Bill Murray famously said in the movie Stripes a long time ago, America is a nation of mutts. We are great precisely because we are diverse, and the energy of every generation of immigrants who had the initiative to leave persecution and poverty and war and seek a new life here has created the great country that we are. Passover, which celebrates freedom, also most certainly celebrates immigration. And so to play us in this morning, less than a fortnight before Pesach begins, here's Yonatan Reisel and Yaakov Shweki singing a text from the Passover Haggadah, V'hi she'amda, this is that promise which sustained our fathers and us. It is not one enemy alone who stood up against us to destroy us, but in each generation there are those who stand up to destroy us. But the Holy Blessed One saves us from their hand. V'hi she'amda. Veni se amda la boteinu velanu shelo echad divad omed aleinu lechanoteinu omed aleinu lechanoteinu la boteinu matzi That was V'hi She'amda from the Haggadah for Passover, coming to a Seder near you Friday night, March 30th, and Saturday, March 31st. Our guest this morning is Professor Stephen M. Cohen, the prominent sociologist of Hebrew Union College, who has authored some of the most important studies of the American Jewish community over the recent past. His new study has just been released, entitled The Portrait of Bay Area Jewish Life and Communities, and he has findings that are both expected and very surprising, and reflect on the future of American Judaism. Hear all about them when we return in a moment on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Professor Stephen M. Cohen, who is perhaps the most prominent person researching the American Jewish community today, sociologist and lead researcher on the new population study, A Portrait of Bay Area Jewish Life and Communities. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning to you.
So studying the American Jewish community is always an interesting problem. Tell us what prompted this new study, particularly of the Bay Area, a large but not perhaps terribly well understood Jewish community.
The study was sponsored by the Jewish Community Federation in the Bay Area, and their interest is in learning about the Jewish population and in providing information about the Jewish population to the various actors and agencies that that serve, mobilize, organize the extended Jewish community in the 10-county Bay Area. So it came out of a need on the part of a philanthropic organization that cares about the Jewish community to serve that community.
What are the difficulties in studying the American Jewish community today?
The difficulties are, some of them are methodological, some are conceptual, some are communication. And methodology, it's difficult to reach a random sample of people. And we used to rely on phones, and this is a study in which we had to leave the telephone because people simply wouldn't answer. They wouldn't answer a call they didn't recognize. So that was one issue.
Hey, listen, my kids won't answer the phone when they recognize it. They only know how to text and respond to Instagram and Snapchat. So.
Right. So there's a changing technology. There's conceptual difficulty in that. As the boundaries between Jews and non-Jews loosen, it becomes more difficult to advance a definition of being Jewish that everybody would agree to. And we use the very, very broad and expansive definition of who's Jewish. And other people might say, gee, that was too broad. I mean, I feel broader than, for example, the Pew Research Center was. And there is a landmark study in 2013. We included people who say that they're Jewish, who have a Jewish family member of some sort, and who might say they belong to another religion, and that was fine. And so there are a small number of those in the population. So we have a broader definition. And then there's a problem of communication. You know, once you pull together the information, you start analyzing it. you present data which challenges people's preconceptions, and you're in a no-win situation, because if we present them with information, the public with information they already knew, they'll ask, well, why do we spend so much money on these sociologists to analyze our community? We already knew that.
Right.
If you present them information that it seems counterintuitive, they go, oh, that can't be right. These sociologists, they came from New York, and
what do they
Israel,
know about us?
And they showed up, and so how can they say that? So I had a friend once who studied the Jews of Libya, and he said it was really really easy to study the Jews of Libya as opposed to the Jews of the United States, because the Jews of Libya pretty much didn't read his work, and they didn't give him grief. But here we have a different situation, and we have a living community. I'm very pleased to be able to help enlighten, serve a living community. But that means that you have, you know, you have to be very, very careful about how you present findings. This is not like writing about Greek literature, you know.
Right. This is not exploring, you know, medieval Jewish communities. This is right now, today, and everybody's got an opinion. We will hear about those findings and much more from Professor Stephen M. Cohen when we return in just a few moments here on Too Jewish.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at toojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's toojewishradio18@gmail. Or visit our website at toojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store, is a very popular Jewish podcast, top 10 in North America. We are approaching the 70th birthday of the State of Israel, and as part of our build-up to this huge celebration, for the next few weeks, Too Jewish will have spots from both our Israeli Shin Shinim and our Mevina on Israel. And soon, we'll introduce a new Maven on Israel as well.
We welcome our Shin Shinim, Chen Denachi and Tamir Shakuri, who are representing Israel in America. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
It's always great having you guys here. You are in a unique position to experience and explore the similarities and differences between Israeli teens and American Jewish teens, because you've now lived with, taught with, hung out with, discussed, engaged with American Jewish teens. And you guys came over here at 18 years old to represent Israel. Tell us about some of the similarities and the differences between American Jewish teens and Israeli teens.
Well, I have to say that we're actually a lot more alike than I would think. Growing up in completely different continents and just very, very far away. But I think the fact that we're all teenagers kind of makes us have this very special similarities. I also think that It's very different circumstances to grow up in. For instance, Tamir and I here have lived through three wars on our own soil, on our own land, and it's like, it's just, you get a little like scared, like an existential fear that I think American teenagers don't have, and that's a good thing. Like I am here for 6 months now, and I still don't know where I would rather grow up, because I think it is good. You do not need to grow up with an existential fear. I also think that it's kind of like Israelis are a lot more upfront. So also as teenagers, which here sometimes I see like they're a lot more subtle, like in a good way maybe. But also like I'm not used to it because I'm used to like
Israelis really put it up front. I've never heard that before.
So I'm used to it. I'm used to like, sure, knowing whatever the person in front of me is thinking. So I think that's also a difference. And I don't know, it's just, it's very, all of the differences I can find reasons for. So it makes sense to me.
Tamir, what are your thoughts? You know, now having had this experience over the course of good part of the year.
I feel like a lot of the differences are just like circumstantial, because we live in a country where you have to serve in the army and it is mandatory to volunteer in part of your high school years. It is mandatory to do 60 years and I think 90 years for the first year volunteering.
60 days, you mean?
60 hours. 60 hours.
Oh, 60
Did I
hours.
Say years?
Okay. You said 60 years, which is a really long time to volunteer.
Yeah, that'll
in the
be, that'll be a long time.
Apparently, math can be different in Israel, too. So.
Yeah, 60 hours. And I feel like most of the Israeli teenagers, without even having to do it, are doing it anyways. So it's just that youth movements and Magen David Adom, which is like the Israeli Red Cross.
Red Cross, right, yeah.
Those are something that really make Israeli teens feel more involved and feel like more connected to their country, because it is a small country. And we feel like as teenagers, we each have to give our own share to make this country grow and succeed, because we need the help from inside, because we don't have the help from the outside neighbors.
Not quite.
Yeah. So I feel like Israel has the sense of unity that makes the teenagers feel like they're working together for one cause, and it drives them. It gives them a reason.
It's a very different experience. I remember having a discussion once with a friend about Israeli teens and American Jewish teens, and I thought, oh, you know, they're all Jews. It's all the same. And he's like, you know, they have nothing in common. And I think maybe that's closer than my original observation. I was upset about it at the time, but I think really that circumstance does make for some really fascinating and powerful differences. Thank you so much. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
We are also exploring Israel's 70th anniversary, 70 years to be biblical about it, with a new Two Jewish feature, a look at each decade of Israel's existence from 1948 to 2018 through a revealing headline from each year and a signature melody. And so this morning we begin the process of reviewing the history of the Jewish state, 70 years of Israel in 7 weeks, with a headline from 1948. Oh, Lord. Our first historic headlines come from May 15, 1948, the first from the New York Times, which in large font proclaimed, just below the masthead, "Zionists proclaim new state of Israel, Truman recognizes it and hopes for peace, Tel Aviv is bombed, and Egypt orders invasion." The Palestine Post, paper of record for Jews in the nascent state, which soon was to change its name to the Jerusalem Post, headlined "State of Israel Born," with similar subheads. The drama of the events of 1948 cannot be overstated. Less than 3 years after the end of the Shoah, the Holocaust, a new Jewish nation was voted into existence by the UN. And under extremely challenging circumstances, a tiny new state was created. It wasn't only Egypt that invaded Israel, it was actually five organized Arab armies. Egypt, Jordan, Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon, large irregular local Palestinian Arab forces, as well as supporting troops from Saudi Arabia, Sudan, Yemen, and Morocco, all attacked Israel. The Israeli army was organized primarily as secret underground forces under the British, who resisted them, but they were facing professional militaries here, armed with far more modern weapons. The Israeli Air Force barely existed, but since the Jews were fighting for their survival, the Israeli forces utilized virtually the whole local Jewish population in one way or another and became steadily stronger even while under attack. The Israeli military established a high standard for levels of performance that became the expected norm for the IDF ever after. The War of Independence, the Milchemet HaShichrur, was hard fought and extended. The last battles did not conclude until March of 1949, 10 months after the Arab invasion, when the war broke out in earnest. Over 6,000 Israelis died. About 1% of the total Jewish population of Israel, that would be comparable to an American war today in which 3.5 million people were killed. Imagine. The toughest loss for the Israelis was the Old City and the Jewish quarter of Jerusalem, taken by the Arab Legion of Transjordan after a brutal siege. Many Israelis died fighting in the valley leading from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, trying to relieve the siege in a place called in Arabic Bab el Wad. Even in the miraculous victory and the establishment of the first Jewish nation in nearly 1,900 years, there was an element of the bittersweet. Bab el Wad. לנצח זכור נא את שמותינו שיירות פרצו בדרך אל החיים בצדי הדרך הם מוטלים מתינו שלד הברזל שותק כמו. That was our first Two Jewish celebration of 70 years of Israel in 7 weeks, a memory from the headlines of 1948. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, you celebrated a birthday recently, your 29th again. 39th. Sorry.
Right, listen.
Don't want to short you. In Veracruz, Mexico, which has, it's an interesting place in general, the Caribbean part of Mexico, early port, and it had a Jewish presence early on.
Right. Technically, as they pointed out to me many times, it's not Caribbean because the Caribbean Sea begins on the other side of the Straits of Florida, the narrow neck
that little...
between Florida and Cuba.
Okay.
What's west of there is the Gulf of Mexico. What's east of there is the Caribbean, technically. But you're right in that this is a place with rum rather than tequila, palm trees rather than cactus, whatever. It feels very tropical and very similar to the Caribbean, even if technically
it's
not.
A Gulf state. Okay.
So, Gulf City. I mean, there's a lot of interesting things about Veracruz. One is that very few U.S. tourists go there.
Right.
There's a huge number of Mexican tourists who like the beaches and the beauty of the broad avenues that follow around the bay. And there's a terrific aquarium and a lot of history. A lot of Mexican history happened there. It's the port through which Cortez entered Mexico. It is the port through which every would-be invader came on their way to Mexico City, and then they had to go up through the jungle and through the mountains and try to take Mexico City if they survived the malaria and everything else.
Yeah, I mean, that goes all the way up to the Mexican War in 1848. So,
right.
You know, long tradition.
Right, if not even more recently. Apparently, the U.S. invaded there once.
Yes, that's right.
So that was probably after 1848.
Definitely in 1848 they did. And then I think maybe the French came. I mean, everybody has come through Veracruz, right?
So I don't know how much of a Jewish community there is today, but one of the biggest monuments along the waterfront is to Eastern European Jews who escaped the Holocaust, were welcomed to Mexico, and I know many of these people personally.
Right.
And they all came through the port of Veracruz. So there's a big monument that lists a lot of names. And Mexico can be proud of the fact that it welcomed Jews fleeing from the Holocaust when the U.S. turned them away, sometimes by force, sometimes sending boatloads of people back to Europe to die. Almost next to this, maybe, I don't know, 200 meters to the north, also along the seafront, is a monument that in some ways replicates the same sentiments, but it's erected to immigrants from Lebanon who entered Mexico through Veracruz at various points in history. And the list of names, which is long, includes names that are obviously Christian, obviously Jewish, and obviously Muslim, reflecting the true diversity of Lebanon. So there may, in fact, be a lot of local pride in having welcomed and served as a port of entry for so many immigrants, regardless of their faith, who found a place in Mexican society and made a contribution to Mexican history and culture.
Fascinating. Really interesting. Mexican Jewish community in general is interesting, but places like Veracruz that I think most American Jews don't know anything about carry a piece of that. Thanks so much, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome Oshrat Barel, our Mivina in Israel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So let's talk about something kind of silly, but not so silly. Israel has changed. The culture continues to change. When I first went there, the best way to get around the country was to hitchhike. And that was certainly true because no Israeli soldier ever hitchhiked without getting picked up and taken somewhere by very quickly. And whether that was true in the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, everybody, you know, you went out, you stuck your thumb out on the road, down, I think they used to do it, and then you'd get, maybe up, and then you'd get picked up and taken somewhere. That has changed. Tell us about your
dramatically
experience recently.
First of all, 20, 30 years ago, you didn't have a lot of chances, choices. So
right. Yeah, there wasn't a lot of other transport. And the bus might be 3 hours from now before it came. And
so,
break down.
Yeah, I remember that even driving with my parents, that my mom will stop the car, you know, without even thinking, you know, the kids are ahora. You know, now, no way. If my kids are in the car, forget it, I won't stop. Even by myself, and I was in Israel recently, you know, and I had my own car, and I could have, you know, and I saw people... religious, and I always like thought, and I'm a little bit impressed, you know, maybe it's an Arab who you know.
Maybe it's someone who's dressed up as
an
Orthodox Jew, but is actually a terrorist.
Yeah, mamash. Right. So again, I'm embarrassed, but you know, I don't have the same sense of
trust.
trust, yeah. you know. And
it's like there's a certain innocence that's not there.
Yeah, mamash.
It's also true that, as we talked about last week, mass transit is fantastically better now than it used to be in Israel. But there's also something lost in terms of that sense of a small country in which everybody helps out everybody else.
Nachon.
There's also been, you know, incidents where people hitchhiking have been carried off by terrorists. So it's really changed that level of trust.
Legamre.
I would say in America, we lost that trust a really long time ago. Maybe Israel is only now coming into that
circumstance.
We're
younger.
Yeah.
We're teenagers.
Not even 70 yet.
Yes.
Just a kid.
Yeah.
When you travel around Israel now, have you noticed any other cultural changes that are like that, in which you would do something and now you don't do it anymore?
That's a very good question, but no, I guess yes, but I don't know.
I think it's also the case that it's a more sophisticated country, and the more sophisticated you get, the less you trust, perhaps.
Yes. You know, it was, to say in one word, I think like the 70s, 80s, even 90s, you know, it was still like a sense of a family, you know. Mm-hmm. And then with the big aliyah from Russia,
and
then the global, all the globalization, these two things, you know, kind of create more individualism in Israel. You see it here, but I started to see it also in Israel.
Yeah,
it's less
collective, less community, less socialist and more, mentality.
Yes.
And less socialist in the economy too, of course. And that changes things for the good, and also in some things are lost.
Nachon.
Thanks, Ashrad. We'll talk next week.
Toda rabai.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. The Goldbergs have just gotten married. On their way to their honeymoon, Mr. Goldberg has a troubling thought. He says to his new wife, "Honey, would you have married me if my father hadn't left me a fortune?" And his bride replies reassuringly, "Oh, darling, I would have married you no matter who left you a fortune." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion is the second in the book of Leviticus Tzav, a section that establishes the rules for the various sacrifices offered in the tabernacle in the wilderness, the Mishkan, and the temple in Jerusalem. Many different types of sacrifices are commanded: burnt offerings, guilt offerings, sin offerings, and so on. But one group of sacrificial offerings stands out, the offerings of peace, the Zevach Shlamim. Among this higher category, one in particular rises higher still, the Zevach HaTodah, the thanksgiving offering. The rabbis thought so highly of thanksgiving to God that they are quoted in the Talmud, saying that even when the Messiah comes and all sacrifices will have completed their mission, all will be discontinued, but one exception will be made, the thanksgiving offering. That sacrifice will last forever. Even in a perfect world, we must remember to give thanks, to be grateful for what we have. As we approach the holiday of Pesach, we do well to remember that gratitude for what we have is both the most essential of all religious motivations and the hardest to keep in mind. If we can each take a moment today to write, email, text, or phone our thanks to someone who is important in our lives, we'll begin to renew this great commitment in the Torah portion. We have much for which to be grateful. And if we can also take a moment to thank God for what we have, to be more conscious of those who have less, we'll begin to make this a better world. For thanksgiving should not lead us to complacency, but instead to humility and gratitude. This Shabbat is also the great Sabbath preceding Passover, called Shabbat HaGadol. The name is taken from its famous Haftarah, which proclaims the coming of the great and awesome day of God, in which the prophet Elijah comes and turns the hearts of children to their parents and the hearts of parents to their children. As a father of two teenagers and a 21-year-old, I promise you there are days when it seems like it will take God's direct intervention to make such a prophecy occur. But there are also days when it seems as though Elijah's arrival is imminent, and things go well, for which we as parents must always remember to be grateful, whether or not the Messiah is actually coming yet or not. When we return on to Jewish, our guest, Professor Stephen M. Cohen, the sociologist who has done some of the most important work studying the American Jewish community, will discuss the findings of his newly released study, A Portrait of Bay Area Jewish Life and Communities, and explain its implications for American Judaism at large today. Hear his surprising insights when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In the face of increasingly definitive evidence that Russia tried to influence the results of the U.S. election for president in 2016, either to damage Hillary Clinton or in favor of Donald Trump, it amounts to the same thing, really, Russian dictator, President Vladimir Putin said that Jews or other minorities might have been behind attempts to interfere in the 2016 American presidential elections. In an interview with NBC News, Putin denied charges by U.S. intelligence services that he ordered meddling in the elections, saying the 13 Russian nationals and three Russian companies fingered in an indictment by special counsel Robert Mueller last month do not represent the interests of the Russian state. Maybe they're not even Russians, he said. Maybe they're Ukrainians, Tartars, Jews, you know, just with Russian citizenship. Even that needs to be checked. Maybe they have dual citizenship, maybe a green card. Maybe it's the Americans who paid them for this work. How do you know? I don't know. Among others, the American Jewish Committee condemned Putin's remarks. President Putin suggesting that Russian Federation minorities, be they Ukrainian, Tatar, or Jewish, were behind U.S. elections is eerily reminiscent of the protocols of the Elders of Zion. He should clarify his comments at the earliest opportunity, the AJC tweeted. Apparently, Twitter is now the preferred method of public discourse on important issues worldwide. Ksenia Svetlova, an Israeli Knesset member from the Zionist Union Party, also tweeted about his remarks, linking it to recent support by the Polish government that would make it a crime to blame Poland for the Holocaust. We are quite familiar with the oldies. Maybe Jews run the world. Maybe Jews use blood for their rituals. Maybe Jews slaughter Jews in Poland. Now comes the latest. Maybe Jews meddled in U.S. elections. Just in time for Pesach, Passover, Vladimir Putin is reviving anti-Semitic Russian tropes that go back centuries, all in the interest of denying his country's not-so-secret efforts to screw up our election for president. Some things never change. Others that are true are just too weird to imagine. This one is both. Ay. Good news for those who drink alcohol on the coming holiday of Passover. You can now add tequila shots and margaritas to your Pesach plans. Patron Silver and Roka Patron Silver are both now certified kosher for Pesach. Patron has always been certified kosher, but that certification has now been extended to include kosher for Passover. So, if you're planning a Mexican theme for your Seder, you can now mix up a matzah and maror margarita to accompany it. It is a holiday, after all, and the Talmud permits you to substitute spirits for wine on special occasions. L'chaim and salud, or perhaps olé. World-famous physicist Stephen Hawking died last week. Hawking, a Brit who wrote the best-selling A Brief History of Time and was the subject of the film The Theory of Everything, and who appeared as himself on The Simpsons and The Big Bang Theory, changed the way we think about the universe. He was the best-known scientist in the world, but a lesser-known aspect of Hawking's ascent to superstardom came from an intellectual duel he had with a Jewish physicist, Jacob Bekenstein, in the early 70s. At the time, Bekenstein, a Polish-Jewish immigrant who was born and grew up in Mexico City, was then a graduate student at Princeton and got into a feud with Hawking, the celebrated physicist and expert on black holes. Black holes are the prima donnas of Albert Einstein's general theory of relativity, which predicts that space wraps itself completely around some object, causing it to disappear as a black hole. Dr. Bekenstein suggested in his PhD thesis that the black hole's entropy was proportional to the area of a black hole's event horizon, the spherical surface in space from which there is no return. According to accepted physical laws, including Hawking's own work, neither entropy nor the area of a black hole could ever decrease. Hawking denounced Bekenstein's idea. According to classical physics, anything with entropy had to have a temperature. Anything with a temperature has to radiate heat and light. But a black hole could not radiate, and thus it could have no temperature and therefore no entropy.
Everybody thought that until 1974, when Hawking did a prodigious calculation, including quantum theory, the strange rules that govern the subatomic world, and he was shocked to find particles coming away from the black hole, indicating it was not totally black after all. After he discovered his mistake, Hawking, as he wrote in A Brief History of Time, kept his calculations quiet at first. He wrote, "I was afraid that if Bekenstein found out about it, he would use it as a further argument to support his ideas about the entropy of black holes, which I still did not like." Hawking was finally convinced when he recognized that the radiation from the black hole would have the same characteristic heat spectrum as heat, just as Bekenstein's theory said. Today it's called Bekenstein-Hawking radiation. Its discovery is a landmark in the unfinished quest to fulfill Albert Einstein's great dream of a unified theory of gravity that bends the cosmos and the quantum chaos that lives inside of it, so-called quantum gravity. Jacob Bekenstein died of a heart attack in 2015, and Stephen Hawking is now gone as well, but their theories live on. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Professor Stephen M. Cohen is a very prominent American sociologist who has produced some of the best work on the American Jewish community. He is the prime researcher on the new study of the Jewish community of the San Francisco Bay Area. Fascinating, a very interesting community. So what were the surprising discoveries in the course of this work, and what came out that was not so surprising?
Who gets surprised, of course, depends on the information they have before. I, as a sociologist of American Jews, fully understand that based on the work of my collaborator, Professor Dr. Jack Euclides. Years ago, Jack did a major study of Jews of the West, and he showed that Jews of the West have far lower rates of Jewish involvement than Jews in Central and Eastern time. Let's put it that way. The time zones of the U.S. are not a bad division. And we found that the Jews of the Bay Area had relatively low rates of Jewish engagement, however you measure such things. But that was consistent with Jews of the West, except for Los Angeles, which is its own case. But aside from Los Angeles, going into the mountain states and the Pacific coast region, Jewish engagement is actually much lower than everywhere else. So I was not surprised. Jack was not surprised by these findings. But maybe people in the Bay Area who are involved in Jewish life, I mean, and a lot of their friends are Jewish engaged, maybe they were surprised by how low some of the numbers were. And like I say, we were not. They also were surprised, and I was not. I don't know about Jack's view, that very few people said that they're interested in increasing their Jewish engagement. They also may have been surprised that welcoming does not seem to be a major barrier to engagement. Jews do not feel unwelcome. The people who are in intergroup couples are not especially unwelcome. They feel about as unwelcome as do single people. Really, the issue is that that in-group couples, Jews married to Jews, have a slightly lower rate of feeling unwelcome. The others a little slightly higher. But welcoming or unwelcoming is really not the issue. We're living in a moment in which people think that social barriers or social identities that distinguish people and lead people to be alienated from one another. That may be true overall, but it's really not an issue in Jewish life. People may feel unwelcome. We didn't get at this, but we saw that there were a major relationship between social class, being wealthy, being middle class, and being poor, inversions in between. That was a strong predictor of Jewish engagement, and even things that didn't cost money. We're not talking about joining a synagogue or belonging to an organization or giving charity. I'm talking about things like feeling being Jewish is important to you, having Jewish friends, of course, lighting Shabbat candles, which still are not that expensive. But things that have nothing to do with money, the people with lower incomes, I'm talking about like under $40,000, under $50,000, under $70,000, were much less active in Jewish life than people making $250 or more,
for example. I don't have a full answer for this, but I speculate that the Jewish community has become more affluent over time, and the San Francisco community is relatively affluent. But the minority who are not affluent are simply not socially engaged with other social networks, friends and family, who are Jewishly active. And therefore, they are less likely either to be recruited into Jewish activity or to feel comfortable, even if they're totally welcome and people are very nice to them, feel comfortable, hanging around with people who happen to be active Jews. And so social class turned out to be a major kind of silent barrier to Jewish engagement, something that I kind of had realized before, but I was surprised to see its power in the Bay Area. And I suspect if I go back to my other data, I'll see it in other places as well.
That's fascinating. That I think is the first time I've heard that.
Oh, good.
You know, so this is...
I hope I'm right.
Well, yeah. I mean, the stereotype is very different on that. And also we tend to think about, for example, ultra-Orthodox Jews who are not necessarily affluent, often below national standards for Jewish income. As being very observant, so it kind of goes against that. Certainly,
right. So, what you call ultra-Orthodox, so they prefer the term Haredi.
Haredi, sure, of course,
or Hasidic, or Litvish. Yes, those Jews are highly active in Jewish life, and they're poor, no question. There are hardly any of them in the Bay Area. In the New York area, 20% of adults are Orthodox. In the Bay Area, 3%.
3%. Wow.
Yeah. So there are hardly any Orthodox Jews, and certainly hardly any ultra Orthodox Jews. So that's really not an issue. And everything I said about social class, I would say, is true for all but the Orthodox. If they take the Orthodox out, even nationally or other communities, New York, Baltimore, or Memphis, Tennessee, actually areas which actually have a high proportion of Orthodox, take them out and then look at the effects of social class on Jewish engagement. I suspect that if I go back to the data, I will find that what I found in the Bay Area is probably true elsewhere. But anyway, it's definitely true in the Bay Area.
Fascinating.
And that's the really major barrier. You want a barrier? Talk about the less affluent. I'm not talking about people who are necessarily on food stamps. There are some of those. There are people who are making $50,000-$60,000 a year who just can't keep up with those people making 5 or 10 or 20 times their incomes. And those other people, the more affluent people, kind of set the tone of the community.
There used to be synagogues that were, I don't know how to say this exactly, but, rich Jews belong to certain synagogues, and less rich Jews belong to working class synagogues.
Yeah. That was, that's still the case to some extent, but the part of the problem is that only a small number of Jews in our sample said that they belong to the synagogue. There's something I think some in the low 20s. I think is the exact number. It's probably around 22% claim that they are members of a synagogue or some other comparable institution. That's not a lot.
It's not. It's no surprise to those of us who live in the Western United States. I think in my own community, Tucson, 17 or 18% belonged to a synagogue way back in 2000. So
that's the number. Yeah. The other thing surprising along the same lines is that 50% of these Jews claimed to have had a Seder. Now, have gone to a Seder.
50%?
50.
About half.
Yeah. And if you speak to anybody who's in Jewish life, and you can always ask yourself, the Seder's coming up. It's like, where are you going for your Seder? Quote unquote, everybody has a Seder. But we have to remember that no, not everybody has a Seder. Half the Jews of the Bay Area do not go to a Seder. And that's just indicative of the extent to which people are so distant from Jewish life. I mean, it's probably the case that the Passover is the most widely observed holiday among American Jews, with the possible exception of Thanksgiving. Hanukkah is not a is a competitor. So between the two of them. So basically we're talking about people who are, you know, not at all observant in any way, shape, or form. And they're out there, and they're part of the Jewish population. And it's important that we recognize who they are, and then think about, you know, how we engage with them.
You've written extensively about intermarriage, and there's a, you could say, a divide within the Jewish community as to whether the goal is outreach to intermarriage or an attempt to focus on in-marriage. The Bay Area has a reputation for being a highly intermarried community, that is, Jews married to non-Jews. What did you find in the study? Was that one of the subjects of it?
Sure, that was a prime issue. You can't study American Jews today and not look at intergroup relationships as being a major driving force and a major dividing a predictor of Jewish engagement. And that's what we found in the Bay Area, the increasing intergroup relationships in terms of marriage and partners. And actually, in our analysis, we lumped together partners and marriage. They were, you know, they turned out not to be all that different in a lot of the characteristics that we correlated with them. So there's increasing intergroup relationships, and there's also a very strong divide between those who are married or partnered to people who are Jewish and married or partnered to people who are other than Jewish. So they really look very different, and I don't understand why you have to choose goals. I mean, whether, you know, outreach or promote, it makes sense to try to engage people who are Jewishly unengaged, and a lot of them happen to be in relationships with people other than Jews. At the same time, if you're dealing with adolescents or young adults, it's in the Jewish community's interest to create social networks among Jews and who are non-married, in the hopes that they will choose to find a Jewish partner, which will probably strengthen the probability that they'll be involved in Jewish life, and they will raise children who they will raise as Jews. Both policies make a lot of sense for American Jews, and one doesn't in any way interfere with the other. You can do both.
One of the ongoing national trends has been the tendency in the millennial generation not to affiliate, not to identify. But maybe a larger one has been a movement away from strong support for Israel, particularly in the Bay Area. Did you find both of those trends continuing?
We did not find disidentification because we did not interview people who are former Jews. So we don't have people who don't identify as Jews in the sample, except if they were members of Jewish households. So that I can't talk to that. I do know in the country, the Pew study, the Pew Research Center, actually did such work, and they did find significant disidentification. That is, of the 7.2 million people who have a Jewish parent, 2.1 million, do not consider themselves Jewish. So that's disidentification. That's going on. I suspect that if we had done such a study in the Bay Area, we would have found maybe a third or a half of people with Jewish parents no longer consider themselves Jewish, which would be consistent with the national portrait. So let's put that one aside. On matters of affiliation, there is some declines and some stability when you look at young versus old. It's primarily driven by intergroup relationships. I mean, that is the fraction of people who have two Jewish parents is going down. The fraction of people who have a Jewish partner or spouse is going down, and those factors predict old versus young differences. All that said, beyond the changes in identity. Yes, there was in various ways, a movement away from Israel engagement, but not to, let's call it, the so-called anti-Israel faction, but people move from Israel engagement to, let's call it, Israel disengagement. You know, we think about, as you know, there are two types of people in the world: those who divide the world into two, and those who don't. So I learned that from Jack Euclid. I believe in dividing the world into three. It's important for policy purposes. So let's not divide the world into pro-Israel and anti-Israel. Let's at least have a middle category, and it's one that's growing and maybe the biggest, and that's Israel disengaged. And if we saw any, we see signs of any movement from old to young, and we don't have over time data, but it kind of makes sense that the young are relative to the old are more likely to be found in the disengaged camp rather than the Israel engaged camp, and that's really what we saw in the data.
I want to thank Professor Stephen M. Cohen for a great visit here on Too Jewish. There is so much more in this data. You can find it by looking up this Portrait of Bay Area Jewish Life and Communities online. And anything you'd like to add as a final observation from this study?
I would say that the bottom line is that it's on the one hand, on the other hand. On the one hand, the commitment and engagement of a lot of Jews really is up for grabs, and on the other hand, we know that there are interventions that over time make a huge difference in people's Jewish engagement. And the issue is: can we get Jews to send their kids to overnight Jewish camps, travel to Israel, get involved on the college campus? Can we build more Jewish preschools, get people involved in the Jewish preschools so their 3-year-olds learn how to say the blessings over
the
Motzi,
right? Sure,
you know, the Motzi and Kiddush and so forth. But create community among parents who haven't yet decided whether to raise their kids as Jews or not, because one parent's Jewish, one parent's not Jewish. There are all these, and can we welcome more people to not just be part of the Jewish community, but to convert to being Jewish, either with a rabbi or without a rabbi. Go through a kind of a cultural conversion, saying, I'm now Jewish. I'm so involved. Can we do all that? And the answer is that we can, but we need more investment in those types of explicit efforts. And if we don't, then we're going to see, and we're seeing, a major climate change in American Jewry that we ought not to deny, and that people who are the number of people who engage in Jewish life who are not Orthodox is really, really shrinking fairly rapidly. From my generation, I'm in my 60s, to my children's generation who are in their 20s and 30s. That's going on right now. What will happen 30 years from now? That's the decision that Jewish policymakers have to confront right now, not tomorrow, not next week, but right now. We have things that we can do and we should do if we think properly and apply ourselves properly, and frankly, invest properly.
I couldn't agree more. Thank you so much. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear a final musical play out and find out about next week's guest.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Cohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be award-winning Jewish writer Tova Mervis, author of the extraordinary new memoir, The Book of Separation. And of course, listen to all of our Top 10 in America podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website. Our playout this morning comes from our pre-Passover preview of Pesach music, a new release from the Maccabees, past guests of Too Jewish, a Justin Bieber parody called Let My People Go. Pesach is now less than 2 weeks away. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
For all the time that you kept us enslaved, and all the back break.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.